Good morning. My name is Malou Innocent. I'm a foreign policy analyst at the Cato Institute, and I am joined by...
I'm Annie Lowry, and I'm an editor and writer at Foreign Policy Magazine. And do you want to talk about what we're going to be discussing this morning?
Yeah, I think the first thing I think we'll be discussing is the apprehension recently of two top Taliban figures in cooperation with the Pakistanis, recently Mullah Baradar and also Mullah Salam. So did you sort of want to start up the discussion and then we can sort of just go back and forth?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that a lot of stuff is going on in Afghanistan and Pakistan. This has been as big a week as I can remember, basically. This is the largest military offensive since the actual initial invasion of Afghanistan. It's enormous. It's, I think, something like 15,000 troops are on the ground. They're fighting about an estimated 2,000 members of the Taliban. And coinciding with this, there's been all of these arrests, which U.S. forces have basically helped the Pakistani ISI arrest these guys. There's Mullah Baradar, who was effectively controlling the Taliban. He was the head of the Quetta Shura. He, except for Mullah Omar, is considered just, you know, basically, you know, the second guy, the second most important guy in the Taliban government. You know, he fought against the Soviets. He's been around for a really long time. And then this morning, there was the announcement that also arrested, I believe also in Pakistan, were two Afghan Taliban guys who were members of the Taliban's shadow government. And so all of these things are happening at once. And I don't know, Malou, if you want to speculate to what extent you think that these things were kind of planned to happen at the same time, like to what extent we can see this is all part of one big plan.
I think that's a good question. I think that time will sort of tell whether this represents a sea change in Pakistan's orientation, both toward the United States and to the Afghan government.
Sure.
For several years, we've sort of been talking about, the political discourse has been talking about sort of the trust deficit that exists and still persists between the United States and Pakistan. Mm-hmm. They were assisting various internal insurgent groups for their own strategic ends vis-a-vis India, vis-a-vis Afghanistan. And so I think that if we really do have Pakistan's unstinting cooperation, that this will really fundamentally alter the dynamics of the war dramatically. But I think in many respects, it's not too soon, at least, I think, to judge this as a complete success, only because in many respects the Pakistanis still perceive the United States, and sort of rightly so, as sort of handing Kabul to the Northern Alliance, which, as we know, is an arm of the Indian government, the Tajik government, Iranian government, Russia, and in many respects so. Will Pakistan sort of alter, you know, its strategic orientation toward Afghanistan? I would hope so. I think it's their sort of self-defeating support for Islamist proxies has been catching up to them, as we've seen, you know, the proliferation of indigenous Taliban groups now. And I would hope at least that we sort of, again, sort of see more cooperation on behalf of the Pakistanis. But at the same time, I hope also that U.S. policymakers understand that for Pakistan, they still perceive India as sort of the greater threat. And I don't think you'd disagree with that too much.
I don't think so.
Right.
So, you know, I think that those are good points to be making. And I think that, you know, the understanding that I have of this is, you know, people have been saying that this is a sea change in the U.S.-Pakistani relationship. Pakistan has really decided to get tough on these guys now. You know, I don't think that tigers normally change their stripes, and I certainly don't think that they change them overnight.
Right.
Even though, obviously, the U.S. is doing a lot better.
Mm-hmm.
This, I think, it's an unqualified, positive sign that they're arresting these folks. But you have to think about, you know, the fundamentals of this. The Taliban has a shadow government. They're like the Tories. They have a shadow mm-hmm. government in Pakistan. They've had this for years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're still calling a lot of the shots in Afghanistan. You know, obviously they're significantly weakened force, but, you know, the Pakistani government is not monolithic. The ISI is not monolithic. And so the extent to which the United States can kind of get the Pakistani government to kind of do stuff depends a lot on a lot of things, and I just don't think it can. You know, I think that there's an understanding that there are certain members of the Pakistani government who have been protecting the Taliban. who have, you know, kind of long-time alliances with them, who, you know, there's a lot of divisiveness within the Pakistani state. So, you know, I think it's a real mistake to think of the Pakistani government as anything like the U.S. government, where you can have, like, directives from on high and can control the governmental apparatus all the way down to the local level, you know, all the way down to the mayors and the police chiefs in Karachi, which is where Baradar was arrested, I think. Yeah, he was in Karachi. And so, you know, again, it's a tentatively positive sign, but it's just, you know, in some ways, I think that it also demonstrates the difficulty of fighting this conflict, is that, it, you know, we're not just fighting, you know, the Taliban, we're not just fighting Al-Qaeda, we're in the midst of basically the most geopolitically complicated region on Earth. And so, you know, when it is that complicated and there are those competing interests, it's, you know, you can't get the Pakistani government to kind of just do as you want. And so, yeah, I guess, you know, to what extent do you think that this should be judged as a success? Because the U.S. government has loved this. You know, the March offensive, by most metrics, has gone really, really well. They were fairly successful in moving civilians out beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've caught all these guys. I guess the question is, like, what's your, you know, what's the fence that they need to be jumping over for you mm-hmm. to declare this kind of a success?
Well, I think I think those are excellent points, and I wholeheartedly agree. I think that we can't consider the Pakistani government as a monolith. Mm-hmm. There are many within the regime, especially the civilians, who do want to sort of reproach Ma with New Delhi. Who mm-hmm. don't necessarily perceive India as the great existential threat that, say, the ISI or many, even within the military, I'm sure it's very divided. Mm-hmm. But I guess in many respects, I think success to me would be, again, a significant shift in how Pakistan perceives the Islamist militants that it used to fund and still sort of assists in many respects. And in that respect, I think policymakers must begin to understand sort of the orientation that Pakistan has had toward India and toward Afghanistan. In many respects, and many Pakistanis that I've spoken to, they are firmly convinced that the United States and India are sort of, you know, scheming and concocting an encirclement of their country. And it's ludicrous. It's sort of this pathological fear. I mean, and we can argue to we're blue in the face to the Pakistanis that this is not the case, but, you know, we haven't lost half our territory to you know, as they did in 71 when they lost Bangladesh. You know, we're not adjacent to a country that's six times our size, that's militarily, economically, demographically more powerful. And so in that respect, I think there needs to be sort of a sense of humility within Foggy Bottom, at least within the State Department, with diplomats and with policymakers, in the sense that sort of getting Pakistan to cooperate effectively with us will really require a bridging of this trust deficit. And so, I mean, it's sort of, you know, how people have tried to shun, you know, the war on terror, you know, label. And you know, granted, I've tried to do the same, but I think people use it as an easy shorthand. But it's not so much a war on terror as I think it's a war of perceptions, especially when you're talking about the sort of strategic competition between India and Pakistan, of course, Pakistan and Afghanistan. And so that, I think, is sort of what I would deem success. But I think I would agree with you also in the sense that there are sort of multiple, you know, shifting gears in this war. You know, there's talks of integrating low-level Taliban insurgents on the ground through, you know, clear, mm-hmm. hold, and build, and, you know, trying to wean them away from tribes. There's also, you know, the counterterrorism operations that we're pursuing with the ISI, and that's the capture of these Taliban militants. But then there's also this sort of, you know, counter-corruption that we're trying to push onto Karzai. And it's sort of funny how we've sort of conveniently ignored, not us two, but sort of the political discourse, and sort of ignored the August elections and the fact that even though Karzai was elected, he's still not deemed, you know, a legitimate political figure.
Far from it.
Right, and so are we sort of operating with the same countries, with the same mentalities, the same networks, and the same politicians and political figures, and expecting a different result? That's sort of my overarching fear and concern when it comes to the war. And granted, I do think that this capture was a success. I do think it definitely helps the war effort. Yeah. Any sort of people we can nab for intelligence and sort of stuff on the ground is critical. But I do that again. There, how many more Baradars are there? How many more?
A lot.
Exactly, right. And I mean, if they can recruit more from madrasas, if they can recruit more from the hinterland and begin to push more militants into the battlefield, it's a scary thought. But our children's children will be fighting this war, and sort of again, I don't think really anyone's convinced that we'll be out by 2011. I would like to hope that we can scale down our presence. You know, I endorse sort of the counterterrorism approach, but still, I mean, in all respects, we'll be there for a long time. I think we're lucky if we get out of Iraq by 2011, let alone Afghanistan.
And you know, Iraq is a different. Yeah, it's a, you know, it's like you're thinking for a long time about one more, and then you forget that there's another one.
Right, it's a new forgotten war.
Yeah, and you know, I agree with you that what I think is kind of so interesting here is that so all of these things happened together. I think that the U.S. government kind of showed its cards a little bit. Obviously, mm-hmm. Barack Obama's decision to amp up the war, to say we're sending all of these other troops and, you know, we are going to basically have a whole of government approach and, you know, we're going to do a lot more militarily, but we're also going to do a lot more, you know, in terms of, like, local government stuff and agriculture stuff and Pakistan stuff and counterterrorism stuff. And, mm-hmm. you know, I think that they've taken this kind of holistic approach, and that wasn't a very pretty way to describe it, but it's true that you're seeing a much broader-based effort mm-hmm. On the part of the U.S. government. And I think that you can see this in the sense that they've had what's a really great operation for the CIA. You know, well mm-hmm. done to the CIA for catching these guys. I presume that, you know, it was them and JSOC and the ISI that really did a lot of work to get this done. At the same time, excuse me, mm-hmm. that you're seeing this massive, massive military offensive. And so I think that it's been interesting watching the U.S. press kind of react to this in sort of this extremely confused way mm-hmm. by saying, like, oh, my God, is this guy, you know, going to know where Osama bin Laden is? And then you're like, well, Osama bin Laden, you know, is an entirely different case.
Right.
And, you know, if he knows where Osama, that would be great. But, you know, this is not this is a lot of things happening that are solving a lot of really complicated problems.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I think that you're right that you know, in Kabul – in Afghanistan, the governance problems are massive, and I think that those problems are the more intractable ones. And mm-hmm. I think that the success of the military offensive has shown, again, the U.S. is great at fighting, mm-hmm. Unparalleled at fighting, mm-hmm. and can really get a lot done when it decides to do this. Obviously, you know, the Taliban put, I think, you know, the number of members of the Taliban who are still around in Afghanistan is actually, in Afghanistan and in Pakistan, it's pretty small. Mm-hmm. And this was a really big fight for both sides. Mm-hmm. But, you know, even still, you have these governance problems that I think that you pointed to, you know, with the election, that the United States, it's not clear how we're going to tackle them. I'm not sure that they have a great plan for doing it. You mm-hmm. know, if they do, I haven't seen a ton of evidence of it. I'm personally very much a skeptic mm-hmm. of what the Obama administration is trying to do. I think that I think that the goal is good. I just don't know how it will actually work.
Right, right. I agree. I mean, I'm extremely apprehensive about whether or not we can achieve the objectives that we hope to achieve within the time frame that Obama's laid out. We're talking about the next 18 to 24 months. We're talking about whether this war can be politically sustainable. Because, I mean, Barack Obama is a political creature. He does face re-election. And sort of in that respect, can you endure the 700 to 800 casualties a year? I mean, it's scary. It's a scary prospect. But can he sell this war? You saw numbers, and I mean, the public is a bit fickle on wars. Right after his speech for the second surge, I call it the second surge because it was the second surge last year, late last year, when he said, you know, that we're going to surge an extra 30,000 troops, and we're going to have more civil to military cooperation. Mm-hmm. You know, the country was essentially divided. I think it was like 51% endorsed Obama's approach. There was like 49% or so that was sort of more skeptical, sort of taking our view. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting is that after the Christmas Day crotch bomber, numbers plummeted. And I think it shows, number one, that we can still remain vulnerable to an attack, so why on earth are we sending more troops? You know, so that disconnect is still there. That's number one. Number two, I think sort of, again, can we achieve the objectives we hope within the time frame again? If you look at what you mentioned earlier as far as the governing structure and the fact that we're still relying on Karzai and, you know, some of his many allies, it's sort of like, you know, 3/4 of Afghans live in the rural parts of the country. So certainly we can create a defensive posture in the cities, maybe protect the transportation routes. But in the countryside, where the Taliban insurgency is strongest, we see some of the dynamics that actually led to the Taliban's rise back in the 1990s, where the Taliban insurgents offer their own form of protection. They offer themselves as a righteous alternative to the sort of chaos and corruption swirling around them. And and from what I understand, at least, many of these insurgents, you know, of course they are repressive, they're misogynistic, what have you, but they also offer something that we can't. They are arbiters in property disputes. They offer, judicial sort of, appeasement and issues when it comes to local conflicts. And sort of, so the question is, can we create a system that can supplant that indigenous structure in the tribal areas and in the sort of countryside? Again, I'm sort of skeptical of that. I know that McChrystal likes to say that. Sure. I guess we have to sort of roll out the government in a box.
My goodness.
Yeah.
We should talk about that phrase, because I think that is, I wish he had never said it. I think it is deeply offensive.
Yeah.
I think that it encapsulates everything that's wrong with this.
Mm-hmm.
Government in a box? Can you imagine, like, trying to go to a town in Maine, removing the local government, and, like, you know, unleashing a government in a box, or Colorado, or any U.S. state?
Right.
This doesn't work. You know, I think that you can say that Afghanistan's centralized government is just, you know, total, it's a bit of a mess. But on the local level, yeah, you know, there are governance structures, and they're hard for the U.S. to work with, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that the prospect of, you know, cooperating with the Taliban is, of course, terrifying. You know, they're horrible about the rights of women. You know, it's there's a lot of problems there, and certainly, you know, to have, like, basically an armed rebel force being the government, you know, how the U.S. could work with that is sort of a difficult question. But I think on the general subject of appeasement with the Taliban, of taking these low-level members who are from, you know, particularly rural areas and working with them, you know, I'm skeptical of it, but then again, I think that Afghanistan is a place where you're basically choosing among bad and worse options in general.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, you know, I think that this is something which increasingly I think we might be looking at, particularly because I think that you're right. You know, within 18 months, realistically, what can the United States do to you know, you can put a government in a box and enroll one of those in every single town in Afghanistan, and you're still not going to, you know, you're not going to solve anything.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. And actually, I think you saw this in the Marja Offensive. You know, the place where we've sent 15,000 troops into this area to control, there's a lot of people living there. I think that I saw one number that there was 1,100 families. There were no towns there.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, basically a rural area that was, you know, controlled by some local folks. But, you know, there's no there. And so, you know, how they're going to unroll this government and you know, build a courthouse and do whatever. I think that was really, really a mistake from McChrystal to say.
Right.
And I don't know if you agree with that or you think that it's more complicated. Or
No. I mean, I agree. I mean, it's sort of... It sort of is my concern also. I mean, this sort of, you know, the government in a box. It's sort of, you know, an army in a box. Can we create the security forces, the Afghan security forces? And again, can we supplant these indigenous structures that do provide some semblance of order and stability, not necessarily in the way that we seek it? And again, speaking as a woman, I think it's abhorrent, the practices, you know, that are practiced there, of course. But in some respects, can the ANA and the ANP offer the protection that insurgents are offering? I think, you know, Ahmed Rashid, I think many of the scholars in the region who, you know, who definitely live and breathe this region, they can sort of understand the complexity also, in the sense that in trying to create a security force that can stand up as we stand down, whether that's in 2011, 2012, 2013, moving forward, it'll be very difficult, number one, because even the numbers that we're trying to reach with the ANA of, mm-hmm. you know, right now I think there are about 60,000 that are capable of operations, and yet there's a turnover, what I've been reading at least, a turnover of 25% a year. So you have those high, you know, desertion rates on top of the fact that, as you mentioned, like, can you have a national army without a sense of national cohesion? Can you sort of, as you mentioned, you know, Maine, you know, what happens, what operates in Maine is much different than what operates in Florida and what operates mm-hmm. in California. So what could work in Mazar-e-Sharif is much different than what could work in Kabul, what could work in Kandahar. So again, sort of applying this sort of national army model to the country is a bit, I mean, I'm a skeptic, I'm hopeful, and I think, you know, something might pan out, but also we're sort of betting on this, in this really risky gamble, and I'm very skeptical, but I'm also very worried also, because I think our military, as you said, I think they have performed brilliantly under the circumstances, but I almost feel that our policymakers are giving them so much of a burden, it's spectacularly ambitious to give them this sort of mission. We're asking them not only to be offensive oriented fighters, but also development workers. We're asking them to be arbiters in disputes. We're asking them to, you know, fix doors and windows. It's a lot to ask our military, and this is sort of why I push the policymakers and diplomats to look at the region as a whole, because countries in this region have always had an incentive to manipulate the internal ethnic divisions of the country, and so we can bring hundreds of Taliban to our side on the ground, but if there are thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands more who operate on the opposite side of the border and are willing to fight, then again, we'll be there for generations. And
absolutely. There are two political science professors, and I think it's the University of North Texas, who I really like, mm-hmm. who performed this massive counterinsurgency study. And they took all of the counterinsurgencies in the last 100 years and kind of, you know, put them into a spreadsheet or whatever it is, like perform this statistical analysis. Mm-hmm. And the longer you stay in a country, the lower your chance of success in a coin war gets. And even if you switch to a hearts and minds strategy, which, you know, the United States has, mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't help, basically.
Right.
You're looking at a really, really small chance of success. And I know that, you know, obviously every war is different. You know, this isn't prescriptive. We can't say that the United States has already failed.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that actually what you've seen in the current offensive that's ongoing in Marja is that the United States military is great at fighting. And you know, it's not clear that they're great at these kind of, like, you know, small-scale governance activities that are so, so important. And I actually think that I am skeptical, but, you know, I think that if any approach is going to work, maybe this is the approach that's going to work. But I haven't really seen a lot of data mm-hmm. about how well this is going. Right. I think I've seen a lot of, like, individual examples where folks, either in the military, the State Department, USAID, will say, well, look at this town. It's going great.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I haven't seen metrics about how this is working, you know, regionally. I'm sure that the United States government has them, but you know, nobody has shown them to me. You know, I'd love to see them if they exist.
Mm-hmm.
About actually how well this is going, whether we've brought the old statistics to bear on whether this is working.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's interesting when you kind of, you know, I know that a lot of people who are kind of on the other side of this issue from you and I, who are saying that, you know, the United States really, really needs to escalate and that the Afghans want us there, you know, and there are studies that show that Afghans do want us there, but it's like they want us there to do what?
Yeah.
And I think that in the entire escalation of the war that's been ongoing, the kind of what, the why are we there, what exactly is it that we want to do, and how do we know that we're going to get, you know, that we're going to accomplish what we want to accomplish, you know, I think that's never quite been clarified.
Mm-hmm.
But, again, I think that basically the U.S. military and CIA actions in the last week give me a lot of hope that they are figuring this out, that they are going to, you know, my sense, and this is perspective, this is just guessing, is that you're going to see this sort of fighting escalate for the next, you know, kind of 6 to 12 months.
Mm-hmm.
You might see more offensives like the one at Marjai. Hopefully you'll see a lot more arrests. And then, you know, then basically the U.S. will be able to say, well, we think that the Taliban is weakened enough and that governance is strong enough that we feel comfortable pulling back now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, they might be right to do that at that point. But I agree with you that that hardly means that any kind of, like, permanent changes will have been made. As you mentioned, you know, we can kill a whole bunch of Taliban guys. And this big country is 33 million people. You know, what's to say that the Taliban can't raise another army?
Right, right. And move up the ranks, especially within their command and leadership posts.
Sure.
And I'm interested in that study that you mentioned. Uh-huh. As we know, you know, counterinsurgencies are always context specific. But mm-hmm. I think there are general sort of templates and general lessons that we can glean from these conflicts. And so I would sort of, even though I haven't read it, I'm almost inclined, you know, to believe the findings only because you know, sort of this notion that we can sort of buy off ground level insurgents, it mm-hmm. sort of smacks of what many in this region of the world sort of criticize Americans for, is the sort of materialistic notions that if you simply buy people off, yeah, you can buy people off, you can buy cooperation, but will you buy loyalty? And this is sort of mm-hmm. the concerns that we have with Pakistan, is that we've been shoveling billions of dollars to them, and yet they've been pursuing their own strategic interests. And for understandable reason. So, I mean, sort of, I think even the notion that we can sort of buy off these ground level insurgents, number one, it sort of ignores the Pashtunwali tribal code. It ignores the fact that even though many of them are illiterate, are uneducated, they do have a value structure. They do, many of them do feel that their way of life is being attacked. Mm-hmm. And even though we may not perceive it that way, many in this region do perceive this as a hostile occupation. It's sort of a civil war mixed with an insurgency against a foreign occupier, mixed with it's sort of going back to what you said about how complicated this war really is. I mean, there are sort of multiple reasons why people want to fight. And, you know, you may have a Taliban militant, you may have a tribal elder, you may have a farmer, and at nightfall, they all become one and the same. And so sort of this notion that, again, the government in a box and can we buy them off, it sort of gets farther away from you know, the real issue, which is, you know, what is the strategic interests and what is the end we hope to achieve. But also, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, I feel like this is deja vu almost. It feels like the zeitgeist back in 2002 when we kept talking about Saddam, Saddam, Saddam and not Al-Qaeda. And it's sort of the same now. We keep talking about Taliban, Taliban, Taliban and not Al-Qaeda. And it's sort of what you mentioned about how the media sort of gets confused by all this. I think there's a tendency to sort of aggregate these very distinct enemies. And even though, you know, these groups obviously they network with one another, they are affiliated with one another, in many respects, the indigenous Pakistani Taliban and their, you know, affiliated networks, they're the ones who are providing the concentric circles and the buffer in the tribal areas to Al-Qaeda, not necessarily mm-hmm. the Pashtun militants in Karachi. And so, and you know, it's I bring this up only because I remember shortly after Obama gave his second surge speech back in November, there was this weird Freudian slip by one of the senior administration officials. He said, you know, our goal is to prevent, you know, the reemergence of the Taliban. I mean Al-Qaeda. And so you sort of get the feeling like either number one, we've lost focus about who we're fighting, or number two, we really are trying to pressure the Pakistanis to stop their funding of Islamist militants. And I think that, again, I don't want to go off into conspiracy theory land, but there is sort of...
I think you should.
I think there isn't a... I mean, as an analyst, I mean, you sort of have to look at all of the possibilities. And is this sort of a means, again, to sort of put pressure on Pakistan to stop their support? I mean, they've been supporting militants and proxies since their inception, since 1947, for mm-hmm. again, for their own geostrategic ends.
I entirely agree with you that there is a hilarious conflation of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and, like, you know, Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups. in the U.S. government.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that at the highest levels that we're talking about, you know, I don't think that the Pentagon is confused about that.
Right,
even though I think that, like, you know, in the past they might have been, you know, a decade ago or whatever. There would be this understanding of these groups again as just like all part of the same team or whatever it mm-hmm. is. And, you know, I think that what my hope is that the U.S. will get better at, you know, exploiting the divisions between these different groups and will be more tactically like Pakistan. You know, it's like the Pakistanis are really great at understanding how you can play groups off one another. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen the United States being particularly good at that, but I think it would be pretty great. You know, if they could. And again, you know, we were talking about earlier about how, you know, these kind of offensives in Pakistan on the part of the Pakistani ISI and in Afghanistan brought up Osama bin Laden,
mm-hmm.
and who is presumably in Pakistan, you know, somewhere near the Afghan border, though nobody really knows where he is.
Right.
And have brought up, you know, the fact that perhaps this would be... it's interesting because I think... you know, were they to catch him, and the fact that they caught such a big fish does, you know, remind me that in fact he is there to catch, presumably. I mean, if he isn't dead, he's out there to be caught, and how game-changing that would be. And I really do think that, you know, this is a conspiracy theory of mine, that would be reason enough to go home.
Yeah.
You know, if the U.S. government caught Osama bin Laden and said, like, look, we did what we set out to do way back in 2001 and in 2003, I think that you would really see, actually, you would see great sort of, you know, favorability ratings rise, but I think you would see, you know, kind of support for these wars wane, because what else are you, you know, once you've caught him, what else are you doing? Even though I think that at this point is a simplistic understanding of Al-Qaeda and its affiliates around the world. And so, you know, my hope is that, I think I've been just fantastically impressed with U.S. intelligence catching broader, and Pakistani intelligence, catching these other two members of the Taliban shadow government. And so, you know, I hope that their intel is as good with the, you know, with Al-Qaeda. And I think that, you know, again, it would just be something that I love to see, but I agree with you that's a whole different other question. And you know, this is the thing, is that when we got ourselves into fighting a war on terror, it's global, it's long-term. The fight against Al-Qaeda will never be over, but it doesn't mean that we need to be militarily occupying a bunch of countries that at this point don't have a ton to do with it.
Exactly, yeah, right.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I guess sort of overall, are we succeeding in the war on terror? You know, as you mentioned, I do think that if we are able to apprehend Osama bin Laden, I mean, that would be, wow. I mean, that would be spectacular.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it's sort of weird, though, too, because, I mean, he's alive, he's an icon. If he's dead, he's a martyr. So mm-hmm. I guess the best we can hope for is, you know, to apprehend him in some way. But in this respect, sir, this is where counterinsurgency and counterterrorism are diametrically opposed, and they begin to clash, because the military saying that we need to win hearts and minds, we need to sort of clear, hold, build, you know, put any sort of mantra you want there. And then at the same time, we're relentlessly pulverizing small villages across the border. And granted, I mean, mm-hmm. if you endorse the counterterrorism approach that I want, of course, you know, you can embrace a policy but still have qualms with it. I think, again, you can whack guys with CIA Predator drones all you want. But at the same time, if our goal is to apprehend Osama bin Laden, is launching Predator drone strikes the most effective way? Would clearing and holding tactics also in the tribal areas of Western Pakistan be more effective than simply launching attacks? Because if the objective is to sort of, you know, win territory, and then by that means you sort of decrease the insurgents' mobility, mm-hmm. then so we're doing counterinsurgency in southern and eastern Afghanistan, or we're trying to, and yet mm-hmm. across the border we're doing counterterrorism, and I think it can be effective, and it has been effective at least in the past several weeks catching these high-level Taliban operatives, but our operations, at least our Predator drone strikes, is that expanding the base of support for Al-Qaeda in the tribal areas? Because...
Sure. And I think it must be.
Yeah.
And, you know, I agree with you that there's this kind of tension here, because, you know, I think that there is an understanding, whether it's right or not, we don't quite know yet, that Predator drone strikes along the Afghanistan-Pakistan border basically forced the Taliban to come, you know, to come to the big cities. You know, it pushed these guys out of there. And you know, when you think about how many people we've killed, how many high-level people we've killed with drone strikes, it's really a lot. I can't quite remember exactly how many, but of the kind of list of 20 high-value targets, I think we've killed like 10 or 15 of them. It's really considerable. And you know, at the same time, so I think that it's accomplishing that strategic objective, but it's also eroding, you know, our success in another. I mean, yes, it's you can't run a hearts and minds strategy while you're doing this. And I think that, you know, for the U.S. government, it's a big question as to, you know, how much we want to continue with these really, really successful strikes that preserve American lives. I do think it's true. And are, you know, to be kind of crass about it, are cheaper than sending a whole lot of soldiers in and trying to control the area. It also, to a certain extent, takes the Pakistani military out of the way. You know, we have approval to go perform these drone strikes. You know, it means that we don't have to run these massive joint operations. Yeah, you know, I think that, you know, I don't know what I think about them, but I think it's surely true that the U.S. is going to keep doing them. It's shown no signs that it's going to stop. I think that it considers them successful, and that it's decided that this is a trade-off that it's willing to make.
Right, and I think sort of the debate about drone strikes, it's sort of on the one hand, on the other hand. There's always, on the one hand, they have been successful. They have killed a lot of high-value al-Qaeda operatives. And then on the other hand, you know, can we quantify the number of recruits that our drone operations are facilitating? Can we quantify the hardening of Pakistani sentiment toward our presence? Can we sort of quantify how many more Pashtun tribes are hardening against their sort of, you know, reluctance to want to offer up al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden? So I guess I've written extensively on this issue, and I've come down hard against predator drone strikes. I understand that they are a necessary evil, and you'd need them in a counterterrorism situation. But at the same time, as you know, they are, again, sort of something, it's sort of like the Taliban, like you mentioned earlier. You know, there's a bad option and there's like the worst option. And so, again, if it's between sending 100,000 troops versus ongoing surveillance through drones, well, I'm going to go for drones. At the same time, you do need troops in some respects to have some sort of ground intelligence and to get to sort of the whereabouts of where these insurgents are. And I guess in that respect, you probably want to rely more on Pakistan for that. And of course, there's a whole host of issues with that. But I mean, they speak the language, they know the lay of the land, they know the geography, the territory of the tribal areas. And so relying on them more would make a whole lot more sense. But of course, there's also the issue of the fact that we can't really trust them. And so there's all these sort of issues, as you mentioned, you know, sort of the complexity of the situation. But I think, I guess, moving forward, what the administration can try and do at least is to try and dampen our expectations. And I think the Obama administration has been successful at that, especially with the last speech that he gave. He didn't talk too much about the soaring rhetoric of democracy building. I mean, we all know that Afghanistan is not going to look like, you know, Florida anytime soon. But I think overall, I think the administration has moved away from the idea that they're going to try and pacify all of Afghanistan. I think they just simply want a structure in place that will allow for our withdrawal. But again, that sort of begs a question as far as when will that withdrawal take place?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that it's interesting. I think that, you know, and again, just to be perspective, I don't know this, but I imagine that if we see the kind of like laying out of objectives that if we achieve them, we're going to really start thinking about leaving. I think that those objectives will be military, basically. Or they will be unquantifiably, you know, we want to make sure that all these towns have governance structures or whatever it is. And I think that you can see the model going forward. I agree with your general assessment of war in Afghanistan is something that we, you know, the war will end, the fighting will not. We're going to be there for a long time. But I think that these kind of these civil military teams that you've seen rolled out across the entire country, but particularly in the south and the east, will be a model going forward. I think that you'll see basically folks from USDA, state, USAID, along with military teams, they'll be there for a while. And I think that those teams, you know, if any have been successful at winning hearts and minds, it's them. I think that they'll allow the United States to distribute a lot of aid and basically pump some money into these economies. Although this is something that we were talking about earlier, you know, this whole thing about, well, can't you just buy members of the Taliban off? I'm all for buying people off. I think it's a perfectly fine thing to do. I think the United States should do tactically more of it. You know, I think that it's actually shown to be a pretty effective way to spend dollars, as opposed to sending a soldier if you send a $100 check or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. You know, it's efficient or something.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, Afghanistan is so very poor that basically you just stoke inflation by pumping a lot of money. It's really hard to buy members of the Taliban off because Afghanistan's economy is so terrible. And I think that once you start to see the kind of, like, stabilizing, you know, the fact that the farmers can be more productive, that Afghanistan can maybe be, you know, start basically producing a lot more of its own food and that sort of thing, you know, that would be success, I
mm-hmm.
think,
mm-hmm.
Would be to see some real economic growth and some diminution of this fighting in the south and the east.
Right, right. And I think that sort of goes to what you were saying earlier, which I agree with. I think that Afghans, they're tired of fighting. It's been
mm-hmm.
almost four decades of nonstop internal conflict. And I think as a survival instinct, they're willing to turn to whatever structure offers them security. And so that
mm-hmm.
security is going to be down the road. It's not going to be hundreds of miles away in Kabul. And so
mm-hmm.
again, whether we can bring about some indigenous structure that, number one, maintains the support of the people, and also their loyalty. Again, what's that saying? You know, you can rent an Afghan, you can never buy them. So it's sort of, again, with the Pakistanis, I mean, you can buy cooperation, but can you buy loyalty? And
I think the answer is you know you shouldn't try to
right
and if you're smarter about this you know hypothetically the United States shouldn't need to at some point because I think that you know if you think it's going to take a long time to really get a centralized government that works in Afghanistan you know it's going to take longer in Pakistan
mm-hmm.
And the United States basically I think you know the objectives for Pakistan should be even more moderate than they should be for Afghanistan. And again, I think that eventually what you'll see is you know, the extent to which the United States can offer Pakistan sort of good trade deals to help the Pakistani middle class or whatever else it is, you know, that will be success, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that you'd see, you know, much stronger civil society in Pakistan.
Right.
Do you have anything else? I guess maybe we should switch to Olympics or something.
I think I'll just say one last thing about Afghanistan.
Yeah, of course.
And then we can switch gears. I have a friend in fact shipping out to Marja in about 2 weeks and
wow.
Yeah, and I have a couple of friends who are in the Marines and it's so funny when they talk about I hope I don't get angry emails from USAID, but my Marine friends always criticize USAID because, it's not just strictly to USAID, don't get me wrong, I think they do good work, but I think it reflects their problems with nation building and their problems with state building are endemic to any sort of bureaucracy and agency that tries mm-hmm. to expand its power within Washington and not necessarily in the country in question. And so you see a lot of turf wars between different agencies and different bureaucracies, and I think this is sort of why we've seen so many problems with the nation-building aspect of this, or the nation-building prong in this war. In fact, one of my close friends who actually did, he worked for USDA, for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and he was...
Yeah, and they're doing great work.
Yeah.
A lot of it. Yeah.
Well, what's interesting is that he worked for a year in, I believe it was Nuristan province. Yeah, in Nuristan. And he was at a PRT. He did not. He was the only person within all the PRTs, at least within the USDA. He was the only one who met with his Afghan counterpart in the Ministry of Agriculture. So, are we cooperating effectively with our Afghan counterparts? Are we working in the sort of state building apparatus? Are we working effectively with the Afghans? I hope we are. And I think again, the new direction of this war may take place and may unfold in the next several months. As we see more people deployed.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this isn't a knock against any civilian agency. I think this is an attempt at all agencies. But again, sort of that cooperation is so difficult, particularly when you're dealing with different interests, when you're dealing with budgets, when you're dealing with fiscal year this and that.
Right.
And so it's very difficult, I guess, in just in that respect. I mean, just as a closing, sort of the issue with nation building and state building more generally.
Yeah, I mean, and God, we could talk for hours about this. And, you know, I agree with you entirely about that. And I think that USAID, you know, it as an agency has been sad to be in Washington and watch its budget get slashed. And,
right.
You know, watch it be basically dismantled. You know, and I think that Holbrooke's civil military plan and his kind of consolidation of power there within the State Department has maybe been necessary because USAID basically, you know, didn't have a head for 10 months and really some terrible things happened to it in the Bush administration.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my hope is that when the QDDR review comes through and state really decides what's going to happen to USAID, that at least these funding streams get improved, that, you know, USAID attracts more and better folks to it. But, yeah, you know, I think that's going to be the big question for a year or two from now,
mm-hmm.
is the civilian strategy, which, you know, the civilian surge, which happened over the course of the past year, I guess, you know, especially in the last 6 months, I believe that everybody is deployed now. It's not that many people. It's
Like
1,000 people or something.
Right.
Maybe even less than that. And so, and again, Afghanistan is a Texas-sized country of 30 million. It's a lot of people. 80% of them, I think, are subsistence farmers or rely on subsistence farming.
Right, right,
You know, and so this is going to be something that the U.S. government, I think, is looking at really carefully and thinking about, you know, in order to create the kind of governance structures that we want and the stability that we want, you know, we're going to have to get down to working with the nuts and bolts of development.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, the military probably isn't going to be a lot of help there, and shouldn't be, I don't think.
Right.
Yeah.
So you want to switch gears now, I guess.
Sure.
Kabul Olympics 2016. I've been watching a little bit of it. I've been mostly watching the speed skating and the figure skating. What sports do you like to watch?
Well, so I watched, you know, I haven't been watching. I'm a big fan of the Summer Olympics. I'm not as big a fan of the Winter Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm like your average TV viewer in that sense. And so I watched last night, I watched the men's like half pipe snowboarding, which was hilarious. Sean White won. It's amazing and beautiful to see. And you really got a sense of the Olympic spirit because basically when he won, it was like a celebration like I've never seen. And, you know, there are all these like snowboard guys. And hilariously, the U.S. is like snowboarding outfits were designed to look like plaid shirts and jeans.
Oh, yeah, interesting.
so they looked like very much, you know,
grunge.
I thought that he, you know, they looked like Travis Birkenstock from Clueless.
No,
you know?
Yeah.
But in general, you know, I think that the Winter Olympics are a bit of a snooze, and I think that there's been plenty of, you know, kind of Canada bashing that this is, you know, but a country that we should look to as,
hello?
You know, for
I can't hear you, Annie. Oh no, I lost you. Oh, no.
Oh, no.
No, okay, now I hear you. Okay, now I hear you. Now we're back online. Okay, cool.
Oh, okay,
there
cool.
We go.
So, we've had some technological difficulties.
I was going to say, isn't Canada bashing like a national pastime in the United States? I always like to call Canada, you know, a lame apartment above a really rocking party. And I know I'm going to get tons of hate mail because of that. But it's a joke. It's a joke. Canadians are very sweet and friendly. How much do you think, sort of getting serious for a moment, how much do you think the death of the Georgian loser sort of put a pall over the Olympics or maybe, in a weird way, almost increased viewership? Or do you think it had no effect?
Oh, goodness. Yeah, you know, I think it did. And I think it's interesting because there's not so many Winter Olympic sports, you know, like compared to the summer. I don't know why, like, basketball and track are summer sports as opposed to winter sports.
Right, you
like
think that anything indoors could be winter sports,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it seems like they should like spread the love around a little bit. But, you know, I think that the death of the loser, first of all, so when you're watching the Winter Olympics, I know you mentioned that you were watching a bit of figure skating. I watched, I think, the pairs figure skating the other night. There's, like, a lot of falling over on ice and snow, which is sort of, like, difficult to watch at home. And so the Winter Olympics, kind of watching them, is sort of painful. And then, you know, with the luching accident, you realize, oh, my God, these people are actually going, like, 100 miles an hour during something very slippery. And I think that, you know, I put a lot of blame on the Canadians for this. Like, why in God's name, you know, I know that he made a mistake. I know that it's a dangerous sport. But, like, Oh my goodness!
Yeah,
you know the track was so fast because I guess it's you know considered the fastest track on Earth, and it's like at some point, geez. But I guess that really you know realistically, professional sports in general are like this. You know they often lead to sort of you know the tragic ends of athletes because we really do you know the idea that you push yourself to your physical limit for your entire life or whatever it is. Okay. You see it with the you know. With the football, and this is not, obviously, we're really comparing apples and oranges here, but you see with, like, boxers and football players that they all end up with, you know, horrific neurological diseases at the end of their lives. Mm-hmm. It's really brutal. Sport is brutal.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's definitely true. I think that, I mean, there have been cases of, you know, basketball players collapsing on the court or, you know, uh-huh. a baseball player getting knocked in the temple, you know, I mean, so there are definitely, dangerous sports. I mean, even freak accidents that you'd never think of, but the
sure.
luge, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but luge itself, I mean, that's just, it strikes me as a very insane sport. I mean, you're going, number one, you're on an ice half pipe. You're going 90 miles an hour on top of sharp blades. I mean, it's just, I'm sorry, but I was always sort of fearful when I watch Losers because it just always struck me as a very dangerous sport. And then on top of it, they're talking about the design of the track. You know, there was one of these, you know, bends that it might have been to this and that. And I think one thing I was surprised about with the track, more most of all, is the fact that the pillars weren't protected with padding. So, I mean, if it just had padding or something, you sort of these things in hindsight, you know, we would have changed it, yada, yada, yada. But I'm just surprised that they didn't take that extra precaution. That's all I'm
yeah,
so shocked
I'm totally shocked by. And I actually wonder, and maybe, you know, in comments if we have, like, a luge expert, why they aren't, you know how, like, kids' slides, they have the plastic top as well as the plastic bottom?
Mm-hmm.
I wonder whether you can't do that with luge. Because, you know, you don't really lift off the ice very much, as I understand it. And it seems like it would be a lot safer. And, you know, of course, then the problem is, you know, the viewership, right? You can't see into a closed plastic tube.
Right.
But, yeah, you know, I think obviously every prudential measure that can be put in place should be put in place. Yeah, but the Winter Olympics are really dangerous in a way that I think the Summer Olympics might not be.
Yeah.
You know, skiing is terribly, terribly dangerous. I haven't been skiing in about a decade, but I was talking to a friend who said that now it's like de rigueur on, like, American mountains to wear a helmet. And I'm like, well, that's great. I think they should be doing that,
mm-hmm.
You know, because there's been so many skiing deaths. And so, yeah, and that was why, you know, so maybe I should stick with the less painful sports to watch, which I guess the sport is figure skating. That's the big Winter Olympics sport, right?
Right, and I think how many I'm wondering if they've ever actually done a study on this. How many people just watch the Winter Olympics for bloopers, just to see a figure skater just fall right on their keister
yeah.
or something, you know?
They're totally the blooper Olympics.
Yeah, right.
they're the falling over Olympics.
Yeah, and I guess maybe we can sort of shift the discussion even now if you have some more time, maybe even to whether or not we should be asking Sarah Palin to join the Winter Olympics at some point or,
right.
you know.
Yeah, we have sort of sundry topics here in this blogging heads, but
yeah,
you know, Sarah Palin is a longtime fascination of mine and maybe we can get into a bit of the Tea Party and the Port Huron / Mount Vernon statement, which I believe is being signed today or was signed yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
I took a look at it yesterday, but yeah. So what's your take on Palin?
My take on Palin. I wrote a recent piece on Huffington Post, Sarah Palin's Jihad, and it just talks about the utter absurdity of her foreign policy views. And if people want to look at it, they can. But I mean. I don't think she's necessarily a stupid person. I don't think, I think number one that she can manage people and departments and agencies and institutions. I mean, you have to be if you're, even though she only served 20 months, you have to know how to manage people if you're a governor. If you were a mayor, so I mean that's sort of not in question. I think sort of my question and my concern is: should she be at the helm of the most powerful country in the world? Would you trust her to handle the nuclear football? Would you trust her to make critical policy decisions that you know have implications on not only millions but billions of people? That prospect for me is a bit scary, simply because. You know, I have friends who, you know, they're great at their job, they're great at what they do, but I wouldn't hand them the power to, you know, govern the lives of millions of people. And so I guess that's my concern. And also my concern is how divisive she is. And I know that everyone's sort of divisive. Obama's divisive. Bush was divisive. Clinton's divisive. Everyone's divisive. But her sort of streak of populism struck me as very, very sort of dangerous, only because she was immediately willing to put people into categories of American and un-American. And as someone who's a first-generation American, my mom immigrated actually from Haiti. And she escaped as a political exile under Duvalier. To hear me, who just happens to be from a more cosmopolitan part of the country, to be labeled as un-American, well, why am I more un-American than she is? I mean, I would assume that me, like many other people, are sort of living the American dream. And yet, for her to categorize, certain people, I'm sure she, especially with Tancredo's opening message about, Mexican immigrants. I mean, why is there this categorization? I think we're all sort of Americans, No one's more American.
I think it's crazy. I think to go back to something you said before, I think I'm comfortable saying I don't think she's actually smart enough to manage America. It's 300 million people.
Right.
It's $14 trillion economy. It's a million-person army. I don't. And the problem isn't necessarily intelligence. I don't think that I can make a statement about her intelligence. Lord knows I'm a terrible public speaker.
No.
Lord knows also, I would never, I think that the psychology of people who run for government, for president especially, is really fascinating. I think that you almost have to be, like, a sociopath to do it.
Yeah.
And I think that to a certain extent, that's why, even Barack Obama, who I love and who I voted for, you always have to be skeptical of these people because they can be complete maniacs.
Right.
But I think that she's uninterested, right? She doesn't have foreign policy positions. She hasn't bothered to learn anything about the world, as far as I can tell. I think that the populism that she's tapping into, I don't know if you saw, the Tea Partiers, there was a study that came out yesterday. They're overwhelmingly wealthy, college-educated white men, who I think have been disenfranchised. That's the demographic group which has the highest rate of unemployment, among the higher rates of unemployment of Americans. It's not the highest rate of unemployment, actually. But, you can see that the economic prospects of these people over the last 10 years, their wages haven't gone up.
Right.
They are very indebted. They somehow this idea of the good life, I think, to psychoanalyze them probably a little unfairly, has slipped away. And so she's tapping into that, but I agree with you that's not populism. And I think that declaring that people are un-American because they don't espouse your political values is precisely contrary to what America is all about.
Mm-hmm.
And the big thing is I don't think that she gets it. I don't think that she has a coherent policy view. And so I think that you can look at other, I think that she... I don't know if, I think she's heading in this kind of, like, vaguely libertarian sort of Randian direction, which I'm sure lots of people at Cato are just thrilled about.
I wince only because the Tea Party movement itself is very divided, and libertarians themselves don't agree on a whole host of issues. I mean, you'll have a libertarian who, like me, believes that in a policy of military restraint overseas. You have another libertarian who believes that we should be spreading democracy at the barrel of a gun. And I wouldn't call those people libertarians. I'd call them neoconservative. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, even the sort of the definitions of liberal and conservative and libertarian, it almost serves to obscure as much as it serves to illuminate. And and I think especially on issues of foreign policy, where the sort of left-right dichotomy sort of falls apart, because you have liberals who are humanitarian interventionists, and you have, conservatives or neoconservatives who are very much for interventionism abroad. And so it's sort of difficult to sort of pin down exactly what libertarians think. I think, I think there are some within Cato and within libertarian circles who do like the Tea Party movement. And I think I would agree with someone like Arianna Huffington, who says, there are legitimate grievances for many within the Tea Party movement. They feel that both political parties have abandoned them. And I think that's sort of where you see libertarians at Cato who do see that the Tea Party movement is a force for good. But I think also Libertarians such as myself, and I'm sure many of my colleagues would also sort of step back and say, wait a second, someone like, what is it, the Family Values Council or something council, I forget what their name is, they're against, giving rights to homosexuals, they're against, sort of these social values. For me at least, that's not conservative. It's philosophically inconsistent to call yourself a conservative and a social conservative. Because for me, a social conservative, you're immediately... I mean, isn't conservative sort of, taking personal responsibility and bootstraps mentality? You can't be a social conservative and call yourself a conservative when you're telling people what to do in their own bedrooms. You can't be a conservative if you're telling people who they should marry and what they should do in their private lives. So I think it's sort of this inherent contradiction within sort of the I guess in some respects the various tea parties, because there's not simply one, but sort of this issue of like who owns the conservative soul? How do you define conservatism? And they're sort of trying to hark back to the founding fathers, and I don't think the founding fathers would necessarily like all the strands of the Tea Party movement, especially someone like Sarah Palin. I think they would consider someone like Sarah Palin extremely dangerous. And
I remember, and I think you see that within the Tea Party movement, well, again, talking about this kind of ideological incoherence, which I think that Sarah Palin has. I think if I were a better interviewer, a better journalist, and sat down with her for 20 minutes, I think you could basically get her to back into saying that she's like a freaking global federalist. I just don't think that she knows enough about anything to really have like a coherent position about these things. And I think that you're right, that the members of Tea Parties, they have real grievances. And I think that a lot of them maybe are ideologically coherent. Mm-hmm. I certainly think that the ones who basically say that, like, we want to be Reagan Republicans again, right? We want to have security conservatives, social conservatives, and fiscal conservatives band together and say, like, we're going to support each other's, each other's priorities. Yeah, I think that you see many members of the House and Senate who basically represent that strand of conservatism, mm-hmm. Which makes sense. I think has to do with sort of seeing the world as it is and creating a political response to it. Mm-hmm. But this kind of, I think that the conservative scene is obviously fractured. We have the Democratic and Republican Party, which, they have to be, to a certain extent, they have to hold... they have to kind of act as big tents. They have to hold all of these different things. But I think that that's all well and good, but I think that basically you need to look for internal consistency among a person's worldview. And I think that you're right that, Sarah Palin just doesn't have it. She's not, like, actually interested in policy, mm-hmm. as far as I can tell. And again, I just don't think that she has foreign policy position.
Right. And, I mean, given the complexity of not only foreign policy and domestic policy, but even given the complexity of the fractured conservative movement that you just mentioned, she doesn't grasp that. She doesn't, and as you say, I mean, I don't even know if she really cares all that much. I mean, she has her own political ambitions.
She doesn't seem to.
Right. Yeah. I mean, she doesn't need to know the difference. She doesn't need to distinguish the different strains of libertarianism, of conservatism, of liberalism, for that matter. I mean, I call myself not so much a libertarian. I mean, I do that in shorthand, but I also call myself more like a classical liberal. Would she even know what a classical liberal is? Has she read the Federalist Papers? I highly doubt it. That's not a knock against her. I mean, is there sort of, does she know the positions that she's undertaking when she talks to the Tea Party? Does she understand... And I mean, even the fact that they had Tancredo there. I mean, at the Cato Institute, we're all for open immigration. We're all for, free trade and allowing people to come to the United States. I mean, so even hearing the sort of nativist, jingoist sort of notions that, un-American and immigrants this and immigrant bashing, I mean, that's totally diametrically opposed to what we endorse. And so, I mean, does she understand that, though? And I think you raise a valid concern. And having her, again, I mean, she's very popular. She can draw in the crowds. She can raise a lot of money. But her popularity plummets right when she gets on a major ticket. And so I think she's very dangerous, not only to the United States if she becomes, in a position of greater power, but she's also sort of a danger to conservatives, I think, in many respects. Because, yeah, she might spout the talking points, but at the end of the day, I mean, does she know the nuance of the policies? And does she even care about the nuance of the policies?
I don't think she does. And, ultimately, I think that she's having a moment now. I think she will continue to be a force in American political life. I just don't see people really getting behind her It's hard because she has a lot of fundraising capability, and when it comes down to the brass tacks, that's really important in whether you get to run, and whether, you know, even whether the parties basically support you when you run.
Yeah.
She is a massive fundraising draw.
Exactly.
And will continue to be. But, you know, I think that basically the Republican Party at some point will look and will say, well, we have really smart folks who know a lot about policy, and this is my hope. And even if they represent what might not be a moderate political view, you know, we're going to get behind them. And I think the best example of this is Paul Ryan, a member of the House from, I think, Wisconsin?
Yeah, Wisconsin, right? Yep.
And who has these kind of what I would call fairly radical budget views, which I think are basically bananas and would never pass through Congress. But, you know, he's very ideologically consistent.
Yeah.
And he says, you know, I think we need smaller government, so we're going to slash Medicare rates.
Yeah.
And, you know, I actually don't know a lot about his foreign policy, and I don't know if he's a foreign policy guy. But, you know, and you can look at Huntsman, our ambassador in China, who I think is a Republican who will really watch, and when he gets back, will be a real force to be reckoned with.
Exactly.
And again, yeah, you know, the libertarianism that you describe, I'm sure that there's libertarians of many stripes, but ultimately, yeah, it has a coherent view of American government and aspirations for American government. Whereas, like, I don't get her.
Yeah,
I just don't see it. And I, you know, and it's one of these things where I really do feel like I don't come from real America anymore. That I just, you know, I don't understand the appeal.
Where is my country? The country left me. I didn't leave my country.
Yeah, exactly.
It's sort of on that note, I unfortunately have to go, but this has been a fantastic discussion. Everything from Baradar to Sarah Palin. So, no, this has been fantastic. I hope to continue this, actually. I think we can maybe hopefully continue where we left off on not just Sarah Palin, but also, you know, Paul Ryan and the conservative movement. Maybe we can have another Blogging Heads on that issue.
Yeah, that sounds wonderful. Thank you so much, Malu. And I have to tell you, I think you have the most beautiful name in all of Blogging Heads.
Oh, thanks. I've heard my name described as an alias. So someone's just like, is that really your name? Are you kidding?
Yeah, well, I guess Jaime Cassio is giving you a run for your money.
There you go.
Anyway, well, have a good day, and thank you to everybody who's watched.
Thank you so much, and thank you for all the viewers. Thank you. Take care, Annie.
Bye-bye.
Bye.